Should Christians go to a same-sex wedding? My name is Matthew Lee Anderson, and you are listening to another episode of Mere Fidelity, the podcast where we think together about the Word of God and the world we live in. This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Lexham Press. Thanks to them for sponsoring this episode. You can get all the Lexham Press books of the month at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. You can get 40% off on the February book of the month, a new one, The 10 Commandments for All God's Children, a fat cat book, Natasha Kennedy, Harold Sinkbeil. Our friend Harold, who wrote The Care of Souls, we did a show with him. He did the text for this. This is a children's book. It looks lovely. The art is fantastic. Help form your children to understand, immerse themselves in the Ten Commandments. It's a wonderful book. You can get 40% off on that at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. All right, gents, we're diving in. We're doing this. Alistair is with me.
Oh, man.
Derek is just thrilled that we're going to be talking about this. There's been a bit of a kerfuffle.
There's still time to turn back, guys.
There's still time. We can retreat, run away, run away. There's been a bit of kerfuffle on the Christian internets. So if you're not aware of that, bless you. Congratulations on staying outside of the daily grind of what Christians online are talking about, which is not, in the grand scheme of things, all that important.
Or having a stable emotional life.
Or for having a stable emotional life, because other things to do besides following what the latest controversies are inside of Christian Twitter and beyond. So, well done for you if you're not aware, but there has been a bit of a kerfuffle. Alistair Begg, a pastor in Ohio, gave some counsel to a grandmother on whether she should attend a wedding where her grandson, who identifies as trans, was marrying someone. And Begg, you can go search this all, read this all elsewhere. Begg basically said, if they know your position, that you're opposed, and they're still willing to welcome you to the wedding, then yeah, go. That's fine. And this generated no little controversy. I'm not convinced it generated a lot of light, that it produced the kind of clarity with respect to moral reasoning that I might want, but that's just me. So we thought that we would take up the question of moral complicity. What are the boundaries of complicity when it comes to celebrating actions that we disagree with? Weddings are a very spectacular case of this, guys. They draw a lot of attention because they're a ritual, they're performative. But the question of complicity and participating in other people's morally wrong actions is one that is much more pervasive, right? This is something that we do on a daily basis in some certain contexts, right? People say things, they're self-deceived. We have to make a spot decision. Do we let this deception that this person believes about themselves or about the world go by? Or do we fraternally correct them in that moment? What's our relationship with them? Those are all very hard questions that come up on a regular basis within people's lives. So I think actually there's a way in which we could think about the spectacular cases, but I'd be interested in some point us talking about the quotidian cases as well, the ordinary cases of fraternal correction. So there's the setup. Alistair, I'm gonna let you have the first word on this, because I kind of feel like you probably have meta thoughts about the way in which the discourse around complicity in weddings has gone.
How does social media shape the shape of the
How has social media shaped our judgments and perceptions of complicity in weddings, Alistair?
Around.
Go.
Well, basically, it makes it almost impossible to have reasonable processes of deliberation and reflection. But stepping back from it, I think that the meta issue is about how we arrive at these sorts of judgments. It seems to me that there has been a sort of, it's been treated as a shibboleth issue where Alistair Begg's position was deemed completely inadmissible. And it was not really treated through careful moral reasoning for the most part, but just as something that is a sign of decline, as a sign of unfaithfulness, or as a sign of extreme folly. And the actual logic by which the judgment was reached was not sufficiently interrogated, nor were... It seems to me that these are issues where Alistair Begg's situation may, I would say, would be out of bounds, but yet there are a lot of other cases near to it that would be considerably more complicated. We're dealing within this area with a number of grey areas. We're dealing with things like the degree of complicity you have if you're providing some service for a wedding. Let's say if you're the photographer, or if you're providing the flowers, or if you're providing some place to host it. If you are present at some family event after the wedding as opposed to the wedding, all of these raise different questions. And if we just have the response where certain positions are ruled out without that process of deliberation and consideration of the factors that go into a wise judgment, I think we're not able to deal with that wider range of issues that all of us will, it seems to me, encounter at some point or other in some form or other. And this might not be the issue of a wedding. It might be an issue of your friends or your child's close friends from university are visiting and they want to stay in the same room. And it's likely they're going to have sexual relations out of wedlock. What do you do? Do you cause an offence to them? What do you do in these sorts of situations? How far does complicity go? Do you, let's say it's happening somewhere else, do you allow your child to join them for an event like that? If they're going on a walking holiday, for instance, do you allow them to stay in the same under the same roof? All these sorts of questions are questions that we have to deal with. And unless we have clear principles of moral reasoning by which we arrive at judgments, we're just not equipped for it. And it seems to me that there's a certain sort of... Alistair Begg compared or argued very controversially, it was the worst time to say this, but I think he was right. There's a difference between American fundamentalism and British evangelicalism in the way that these sorts of cases are handled. And American fundamentalism has tended to draw lots of black and white lines. British evangelicalism has been more accustomed to dealing with deliberation and these sorts of moral judgments. And so there are cultural differences at play here as well. Worst time to mention it, though, unfortunately.
You've just doubled down on it.
Can I put in a word for the American fundamentalists as the... I mean, Matt's Canadian. You're obviously a colonial imperialist. And I'm just a good down-home American Presbyterian in Southern California. But really, just to look at that, I guess the pushback initially on the meta issue, like I get that there's a difference in that there's, you know, evangelical, American fundamentalism and British evangelicalism. Look, I love Stott, I love Packer, I love that. And there's times where that matters. And I guess the initial thing is, the initial counterpoint I might make there is like, you know, there is something to be said for the initial snap moral recoil that the fundamentalist might have on a certain boundary issue, and the instinct to draw the clear line, to draw the black and white, perhaps has served them well in maintaining certain boundaries that ought to have been maintained. I don't want to count heads, but British evangelicalism within the Church of England didn't seem to have enough recourse, enough recoil or the ability to draw some of those sharp and fast lines that potentially contributed to the state that it's in, that the Church of England is currently in, versus those very large and somewhat thriving fundamentalist churches that exist in the U.S. that maybe have snap decisions in cases that they shouldn't have, but they had them in the places where they ought to have, quicker. And so they built fences where there needed to be some fences. When a British evangelical might have just, hey, let's try and keep building that bridge, and like that bridge should have been burned. And so I guess there's that question of like, you can over police, but you can under police and sometimes the snap judgment of the unsophisticated, you know, quick unreasoning. I'm not talking about a mob on Twitter, but you know, like, hey, no, that's just wrong. No,
but I think that, like, actually
there's something okay about that.
Yeah, but I think that misconstrues the nature of the comparison or the way in which that Begg drew that contrast, because it's not like Begg's position on the broader question of same-sex marriage is ambiguous, right?
And yeah, so that's true.
The question of line drawing and or putting up fences, as it were, it's different than a question of pastoral advice, right?
Yeah.
What should I do when X? What is the church's position on Y? Those are two different questions. And one of the ways in which this discussion, I think, has been unhelpful is the different context for those questions has been eclipsed, such that those two questions have been blurred together, like many other questions have been blurred together, right? One of the frustrations that I have with this entire discussion is that no one has, one, invoked the language of scandal or sacrilege, right? And no one has asked, when we're talking about these weddings, what types of weddings are we actually talking about? And what do we know about what's happening at these weddings? Those seem like fairly basic questions that you need to ask before you would come to a moral judgment. But what we have is, we actually have an evangelical advice / guru industry where people ask very prominent people for advice in very short, with very short questions, with very little setup about what the situation is. And then that guru is expected to dispense, well, here's what I would do. But it's always underspecified. All of these cases don't actually take into account the full complexity of any practical situation. And as such, when the advice is given, it creates lots of opportunity for people to get very angry about what's being said. But here's a basic question. What's being proclaimed at the wedding that you are deliberating going to? Is the wedding a civil ceremony where there's a justice of the peace and there's not going to be any request for objections like would be in the traditional Book of Common Prayer ceremony? And there's going to be actually no invocation of Jesus Christ, the triune God, etc. Right? Like, is this a purely pagan ceremony? And if it is a purely pagan ceremony, what's the stakes there? Now, if this is a place where the invocation of Jesus Christ is happening, then you might think what's going on in that context is actually theologically very different, right? Because they're holding out the claim that they are brethren in Christ. And so actually the what we talked about in the last show with 1 Corinthians 5, right? Like, you know, 5-6, that like have nothing to do with those who claim to be brothers. That starts to have real purchase.
Yeah.
Right. And so the underspecification of these cases in the advice industry is already a problem out of the gate. It is likely to breed controversy and create distorted moral formation for Christians who are listening to this, who are thinking about their own situations, because they're not being actually provided with the right questions to ask about their situation in the first place.
I think that's absolutely right. There's no principles of moral reasoning that are given. And the problem with fundamentalism is that it offers prepackaged responses, it offers knee-jerk reactions, it offers a sort of legalism that saves you from actually having to do the difficult, responsible work of arriving at moral judgments. And the way that it applies those tend to be quite sectarian, they're treated as shibboleths, and in certain cases, like this one, I think there is a very clear line that has been crossed. If someone is approving of same-sex marriage, there's something very clearly wrong with that. Now, attending such an event while not approving of it is complicated. If it's an event held at a church, I think the sense of approval, some sense of witnessing this event and backing it up by your presence tends to be assumed. And so if you're present at it, I think there's some degree of complicity. And I think Begg's response just wasn't sufficient on that front. But as Matt's saying, there's just not the specification that you need. There's not a sense of the moral principles or the process of moral judgment by which you would arrive at the sort of judgments, not just for this case, but for far more complex grey areas where the specifics of your situation are not going to be ones that can be dealt with in a very abstract level. It requires real wisdom and assessment of a situation according to key questions and principles, and that process of reasoning is just not taught.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in theory, a whole bunch of this I agree with in terms of like, yeah, moral reasoning, lay it out there. We need to have principled approaches. We need more complex pasturing around these things. The fact that you're just doing, like, I do Q&A sessions after my sermons, and a kid will ask me a generic question. It's like, well, what do you do in this situation? It's like, well, you just said an extraordinarily vague thing, and I'm going to give you three options, giving the tiers of what that could mean. But I'm not, you know, if you have a specific thing in mind, just come talk to me afterwards, because this is not going to be sufficient. In theory, all that's true. In the cases like this there, I'm going to, again, put in a good word for shibboleths. Because what is a creed if not a shibboleth to some degree? We come up with creeds, we come up with confessions, and we put specific lines in them. Like the Nicene Creed has specific lines that an Arian cannot utter. And once you know he can't utter it, you know who he is. And so that's an in and an out line that's a test that, like, somebody who can't work through everything that Gregory and the Cappadocians have in mind, they can still ask you that question and they can check. They can know. So there's something there that, like, hey, would you do, like, you can have a moral shibboleth to some degree where it's like, hey, would you do that X or Y? And that can tell you a lot. That's like a spot test, often imperfect in some of these cases. That's a spot test for knowing, like, how, because there's complexities and there's compromise. There is complicity. There are these issues where it's like, hey, if you're willing to do X, I should ask some questions about your moral reasoning that got you there, because now I have reason to wonder. It's not absolute, especially in pastoral advice where, you know, Begg did give a whole bunch of caveats that are important for judging whether or not he's, like, fully blown out the moral roof here. So, you know, within the last year, I mean, I turned on the radio randomly and I did actually happen to catch his sermons on Romans 1 the other day, like a few months ago, and he very clearly lays out his positions on the illicit nature of same-sex relationships, all that kind of thing. But nevertheless, I do think that there are some clearer cases that you should be able to say that's just wrong, that's off, and that was a mistake, and you should be able to own that. One more thing I'll just add there on the pastoral thing, I think you also have to have space for saying that sometimes pastors get stuff wrong in counsel. I don't like the doubling down that he did, and I don't like the way he did it. The Jesus versus the Pharisees framing.
That's fine. But, setting that aside, right? Like, so let's just stay with the main subject here. So I think you're absolutely right that there are certain things that we just ought not go to, ought not celebrate. I actually think that, like, I want to double down on the language of sacrilege and its absence in this context, and the ways in which American evangelicals, even when they speak about weddings, don't have recourse to those sorts of descriptions, the type of profanation that would go on with a parody of a wedding, and the degree in which witnessing a specifically religious wedding is a kind of sacrilege, that what you're seeing is something that is a desecration of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that as such, if that's the context, there should be no participation at all in that. But that's very different than going to a wedding where that desecration is not occurring, because they all manifestly reject the gospel of Jesus Christ and they want nothing to do with it. Like, those seem to be very different types of contexts.
I want to ask you a clarifying question, because here I also think an operative theology of marriage as sacrament or not as sacrament is in play. The Protestant position, as far as I've understood it historically, is that marriage is a gift to all mankind, right? It does point ahead to the mystery of Christ, But when you're witnessing a marriage, even outside of a church, even outside of a church, you're saying something about nature. You're saying something about creation, and you're saying something that does, you know, whether they intend it or not, does impinge on the gospel mystery of Christ. And so you're still talking about truth. You're still talking about God's truth and God's world and God's reality. I'll put it this way. Pronouns are not uniquely, it's not unique gospel grammar.
Yeah.
But to use a pronoun in a certain way is to pronounce about the reality of God's world in a certain way. And so your witnessing still has great moral function, even if it's not the added offense.
I think that's right. I don't
false testimony about the gospel.
Yeah, I think that's right, but I think we regard the levels of complicity in those two different realms in very different ways. And Paul seems to in 1 Corinthians, right? He really does permit eating with unbelievers when this food has been sacrificed to idols, when one knows it's been sacrificed to idols, provided that it doesn't scandalize the other believers. So the criteria that Paul develops in 1 Corinthians with respect to those natural goods and with respect to the life of the Christian community and what's proclaimed as a part of the Christian gospel, I think are just different. He just has different standards for conduct in those two arenas. And it's here's a sociological point that I think actually really matters for American evangelicals. I think that the predominantly Baptist way of thinking about marriage has made American evangelicals uniquely dependent upon the state in terms of how we think about our doctrines of marriage, such that if you think about what it takes to dissolve a marriage within most American evangelical churches, what it takes to dissolve a marriage is actually just a divorce license from the state. Churches do not have internal procedures for annulment like Catholics do. And that absence indicates a peculiar type of dependence on state ceremonies that makes these sorts of distinctions very difficult for an American evangelical to get their head around. And I want to recognize, right, like going to a pagan same-sex wedding, when the couple knows that you object to what's happening, if they are willing to have you come, I still think you're witnessing something that's wrong. I'm very much on the record on that, right? Like, but the nature of the scandal that you would be conveying to other believers with respect to the teachings of the gospel of Jesus Christ is, I think, a very different one. And that's gotten lost in all of this.
I do think if we're thinking about the analogy with Paul's teaching, the analogy might be closer to one of eating an feast that's actually dedicated to idols, as opposed to eating meat that's come from some sacrifice.
Sorry, I think that's right, Alistair. Yeah, I was imprecise in that.
But this drives the point home. There's this level of like, look, I know there's no such thing as the gods are not gods, but there are a demon or two hanging out around these sacrifices. Yeah. And the other thing about that is, so we can say like the level of wrongness is there. It's like, look, hey, there's this added level of insult to the original injury when it comes to like a gospel sacramental invoking marriage ceremony. But the original marriage in itself as a natural good, put it this way, like meat is meat. Meat just is meat. A marriage between a man and a man or a, you know, somebody who's calling themselves a woman who's a man, that sort of thing. Two things are happening. One, it is an inherent parity. It's not actually happening. And yet it is still like a violation of things such that in a way that is different than like meat's nature doesn't ontologically change into not meat or something sinful. You're still just So that's, I think, that's a disanalogous thing that we have to factor in there. So when somebody says, well, you can eat it, you know, as long as you know it's meat, as long as you know it's okay. But the marriage is actually an active act of like rejection of God's laws and standards.
Yeah.
In a way that, so just in the analysis of this situation, that factors as we apply it to other ones as well.
I think that's right. Here's one other sort of meta thought that I've had about all this. And I've had this thought about the ways in which these discussions go for a long time, because I have written about these questions with respect to weddings and complicity in my newsletter for the past 4 or 5 years. Alistair, at the start, you mentioned the case of someone who comes into your home where you have moral objections. That was a case that I took up in the newsletter about 4 years ago because someone asked me, I've got these people coming in my home. I don't know what to do. I object to them. I'm worried about my children. Those are live questions for my readership. And it seems to me that one of the sort of undercurrents or points of disconnect between Begg and his critics is the role of fraternal correction in these disputes. So within American evangelical context, the only category that we have that we think through these issues through is in terms of complicity. That's what we're concerned about. And complicity raises the stakes for my sense of integrity, my sense of purity, if we want to use that sort of language. But they're framed through what may I be complicit in and what might I not be complicit in. What Begg does is he doesn't use this language because, again, he's not tutored. He's not schooled in moral theology in the way in which I wish more evangelicals were. But he actually is approaching the question through the lens of fraternal correction. So the question is, should I go to this wedding? And he says, well, do they understand that you're opposed to it? Do they, are they willing to receive you? It's better to keep the relationship open than close it off, right? And there's a principle when thinking about fraternal correction. Aquinas says this very explicitly in the Summa, that if you think your fraternal correction is likely to make someone worse, it's likely to make them more morally bad or hardened against the truth, then you ought not fraternally correct them. And that's a really interesting principle, right? Because it means that there are situations where actually you would forbear, you would not fraternally correct someone. But it's a very different way of thinking about, it's a very different question to ask some of these types of situations and some of these sorts of relationships, because it's a question of what do I owe to this person in terms of fraternal correction? How can I continue to be in a situation where I'm continuing to draw them closer to the truth while still upholding the norms of the truth, right? And this is just a different framework. And that was Begg's, I took it that that was Begg's framework. And it's a legitimate one, but you have to reconcile that with questions of complicity, and doing so in a general vague way is almost impossible.
Yeah, this is where, but at this point, so that's a good question to ask. And it's one that I've actually talked with students recently. I don't use those terms in terms of recognizing, everybody's known the 20-year-old kid who's really excited about Jesus, all et cetera, and like just, tells his friends, hey, that X, Y, and Z is sinful. You should stop that. It's like you skip like 10 steps of this person's not even close to hearing the gospel, yada, yada. And so I do think there's a distinct, that should be a category. But there's a huge distinction between me telling you that what you're doing is wrong in any and every situation that I could possibly do so, and me going along with you when you invite me to do something that's wrong or to watch something that's wrong or celebrate something that's wrong. Like I don't know, I hadn't read Aquinas on the fraternal correction, but I think non-participation in, yeah, you should. I'll get there, dissertation. But when non-participation in that which is wrong, like there's a sense in which I owe it to you to try to not make you worse. I don't owe it to you to disobey God. I don't owe it to you to violate conscience. So even these pressure situations
or to cause scandal to other believers,
or to
which
cause
is the other category,
other
right? To create confusion within a worshiping community about what I believe about marriage and what the truth of marriage is.
So explaining, this is where, having a loving conversation with somebody and explaining, hey, I love you, I care about you, I would love to support you in all sorts of ways, but here are some reasons why I cannot do that. And if somebody presses you and makes your relationship with them contingent on you violating your conscience, contingent on you actively doing all these sorts of things, at that point, the burden, the relational burden and and in a sense, the aggressiveness in the relationship in some ways is on the person making the demand that you attend, that you do. And I think we often don't appreciate that much, that there's a certain amount of like, look, I will do all sorts of things for you in love, and I want to affirm you in all sorts of ways, but please do not ask me to do this because it's something I cannot do. And if somebody still presses you to do that and makes that the test of your relationship, at that point, they are actually the ones who are willingly breaking the relationship over and against your willingness to love them in all the ways that God allows you to. And so I think that that process also needs to be a factor.
Yeah.
I think one of the things with Begg's approach that many of his critics, it seems to me, are not wrestling with one of the aspects that he's very concerned about, which is communicating love to those with whom you have strong differences. And so as part of the communication of truth, it's the communication that although I do not approve of this relationship, although I do not approve of, I do not believe this is marriage, nor do I believe that it's licit in any way, I want to communicate my love and concern for you as someone I genuinely care about. I want to have continuing bridges with you. I don't want to just reject you. And I want to make sure that as I am making this particular, as I'm resisting this particular affirmation that you're wanting me to give, that I do not thereby give the wrong impression about how I stand relative to you.
Yeah.
That, it seems to me, is one of the things that consistently within a fundamentalist context that wants to draw these really sharp lines and is so fixated upon those, it's one of those things that tends to get missed. And Begg's concern, I think, is an extremely important one if we're going to be telling the truth and if we're going to be loving our enemies and loving members of our families who have these sorts of relationships. How do you maintain those bonds without just cutting people off, as has so often occurred within contexts without these processes of moral reasoning and these forms of creative solving of these conundrums, so that you can, even in rejecting something, find a way to affirm someone in their relationship with you in an appropriate way? That, it seems to me, is a challenge that many have not risen to in rejecting what I think was a significant overstep in Begg's use of that line of reasoning, and one that led him into a severe error, it seems to me.
I think that's right. I think this is partly why weddings are difficult cases, though, because in certain like bilateral contexts where it's just me and the other person, I'll just say I've had this thought about pronouns for a while, and it came up a little bit in our conversation with Abigail Favale at the very end, where in a bilateral context, if someone wants me to use their pronouns, I say, well, I object to the way in which you're thinking about this. I think it's wrong. Here's why. We have a conversation about that. At the end of that, I've made it very clear that I deeply object. And then I say, but I'm willing to use your pronouns now that we are very clear on what's happening and what I think is the truth. I'm willing to use your pronouns. In that sort of case, what am I communicating to that person by using their pronouns? And am I complicit in their deception, right? It's not entirely clear to me that my use is complicit in their deception, because what I've said is effectively, I'm going to act in a social role, and I've made it clear that I'm acting in a social role. And every time I use the pronoun, because you know I deeply disagree that I'm actually saying what I think is a fiction, you know what I'm saying is a fiction, I know what I'm saying is a fiction, and that meaning persists through communication in a bilateral context. But here's the thing, if the people
in
around
a bilateral
me, if
context.
No one else, right, this is why I think weddings are peculiar, because there are lots of people around me who might not know that I've had that sort of conversation, which is why Scandal, I've had a really snarky line that I have not tweeted, which is something like, look, if your local Christian controversialist hasn't invoked the category of scandal in this discussion, they're just not doing it right, right? But the category of scandal about impeding or impairing third parties' faith through my conduct is really operative in these cases. And that seems to me what's peculiar about weddings and peculiar about these sorts of cases that Begg just doesn't have the resources to deal with.
And it seems to me that if you were going to make it clear to everyone at the wedding how you stood relative to the proceedings, you would create more of a stink.
This is one thing. Middle of ceremony, you're like, I'm at this wedding, and you do air quotes in front of the whole wedding.
No. Look, Derek, for real. Like, one writer brought up, like, look, in the Book of Common Prayer, there's a period, does anyone object to this wedding? And I thought, like, yeah, what if you tell the people that you're attending, you say, you just let them know, like, when that's said, I'm going to stand up and object. Now, if it's a secular wedding and they have that, right, I wouldn't go to the wedding that used the BCP that did this sort of thing because I think it's sacrilege. But if it was a secular wedding that gave that sort of opportunity, stand up and say, I object to these proceedings. And the justice of the peace says objection overruled. What's the meaning or the significance of my then continued participation in that event? How does everyone interpret that? Right, it's not clear that everyone interprets this as Matt affirms everything that's happening.
Well, yeah,
in this.
In that rare case, right? People actually do it.
But no one. But here's the thing: no one has entertained that even as a possibility in this. Right, our moral imaginations are so truncated in these cases, and this is partly why I think the discussion is so deeply unhelpful, because it happens at this general level where it's like, should I attend the wedding or should I not? And that actually just truncates our moral imaginations in such a way that we don't actually consider very weird ways of navigating them, like standing up at the wedding and saying genuinely, I do object to what's happening here, right? And I love you guys.
I think that's like, there's a sense in which, okay, so I'm gonna put in for the kind of people who find...
No one's ever going to invite me to their wedding ever again, so we know that. Like, that's...
Exactly. And now Matt's been ruled out,
For lots of reasons.
Just to put in a defense for the kind of people who probably would hate our podcast, some people need clear lines. Like, I think a lot of people are going to, like, you know, I think there are clear lines. I know. I'm saying pastors should know the category of scandal, even if they don't. They might even have it without using the word, right? They might have the concept of like, hey, look, you're going to give offense to, you know, the Greek is rusty like mine. And like, hey, you're going to give offense to onlookers.
It's scandal on. You can figure it out.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe. whatever. Sorry. Some people score higher on what's the term? What's the term for one thing that is, it's the same word. Okay, whatever. This just tells you. Okay, so I'm that guy on the podcast. You might have the category, you might use it, but this, I just think, look, not everybody who's throwing the criticisms out was good faith. They're jumping in, whatever. But I do think some of the element of just looking at and saying this is wrong, this is a line, and we should be able to like give that out. I don't object to that. In fact,
the only way in which the sort of pastoral context or the pastoral conduct that might make sense in this sort of way, in the way which I'm saying, the only way in which that makes sense is if one is unambiguous about the prohibitions. A lack of, like, ambiguity about prohibitions actually makes moral conduct in cases where others disagree with us more complicated. But where everyone knows what a person's moral position is, it actually frees them, I think, to participate in the sinful structures and practices of this world in ways that resist, but also try to maintain relationship. Here's just a case from the Bible that I think we have to bring up that I think is really weird. Naaman, right? We can say this is an Old Testament example, but in terms of thinking about fidelity in social context where you are morally complicit, Naaman is healed, he's cured, he wants to stay, and he is told to go back and participate in idol worship, which he does, right? And that's a really extraordinary moment for thinking about what we are required to do and the possibilities of maintaining faithfulness in contexts where there is real sin and scandal that could happen, right? Like, it's a very interesting biblical moment.
I do think you're overstating that. He's not told to go back and participate in idol worship. There's allowance made for him in the service of his king to be involved in those services that he's required to be involved in for idols. But in the service of his king, he's not told to go back and be involved in idol worship.
Oh, he says, when my master goes in the house of Rimmon to worship there, here's what he says. When my master goes in the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. And he's told, go in peace. So he's going to bow himself.
Yeah, which is obeisance.
Yes, but he's not. He's not told to go back to do that.
But he's given this blessing to go in peace. He asks for permission to do it, right? Like, there is a sense in which he's engaging in an act. He's performing his duties, and he's acknowledged that he doesn't mean any of it. But that seems to change the nature, the theological nature of what he's actually doing. And that's the sort of
kind of
possibility that, again, I think needs to be attended to in these contexts.
And you can imagine someone taking that sort of reasoning for being involved in signing marriage certificates where it's part of their job. They don't have any say in it apart from just leaving their job. But they're very clearly against
that's right.
Certain types of marriages.
There are moral questions here besides complicity. That's all I want to say, right? Like, you know?
It does call to mind, though, other analogies. And this is like early church stuff, right? I mean, I think about it like the, you know, one of the arguments around military service, the question of whether or not military service could happen for Christians, whether or not it was like pure nonviolence or like, oh, no, you have to take an oath to like gods. And you know, there was the involvement of pagan worship of Caesar. And you think, well, Naaman. Or just the willingness to lose financially, lose jobs, lose like the Naaman option, is like, it's an interesting test case to think about. We need to think about it, but it's also starts to become like a very easy escape route on a lot of things. If we don't have the other like very clearer texts and principles in place, so yeah, I mean, I think that it's something to think about when some people are in like complicated work situations, indirect, that sort of thing. But you know, when you've got a willing attendance at a thing that you don't have to go to, et cetera, like that just it makes it a different thing.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But that's where I think dependence upon shibboleths is really a problem, because in certain cases they will prevent you from going in a very bad direction and doing something wrong inadvertently, perhaps. But in so many other cases, what they're doing is giving you a sort of instinct that is contrary to healthy moral reasoning, which you will need in many of these cases where things aren't so clear-cut. And so the multiplication of shibboleths, I think, has been a feature of fundamentalism. And partly because of an anxiety about just the complexity of certain intellectual issues, certain moral issues, certain issues of involvement within society, whether that's the old not drinking, not smoking, not watching TV, you certainly need a lot of these wisdom in these areas. You shouldn't be watching Netflix, Matt would say. But
preach!
At the same time, we do need something more than just those shibboleths. And the more that we just depend upon those sorts of things, the more we end up with a sort of legalistic culture that has damaged a lot of people and led to really unhealthy anxieties that have prevented evangelicalism, fundamentalism, from thinking about certain things that it must think about.
I want to third way it and just say some shibboleths are good and some are not. And so, like, you know, you need to pick and choose the right one. There you go.
Like quit Netflix. That's the shibboleth we all need.
That's Matt's shibboleth.
It's not the shibboleth we deserve, but it's the one we need. Guys, this has been characteristically rowdy. I'm not sure that we have solved any of this. I will just say I'm continuing to be intrigued by the difference between shibboleths proclaimed from the pulpit and those that are taken up by, in particular, pastoral context. And I do want to give begs critics their due. I think the anxiety about some of these things is because of a broader anxiety that people have not been clear on, that pastors have not been clear on the prohibitions that scripture upholds. And that has created vagueness and ambiguity that people are anxious about. They picked the wrong target with Begg because Begg can point to a long history of being very clear on this. But I do, I think that anxiety is understandable, and I don't begrudge it. So there's lots more that we could say. Look forward to arguing with you guys again about some other hot topic pertaining to faith and the world around us. But we're going to call it here. If you have been listening to this episode, we are grateful for your time and attention. Rate and review us on iTunes. Tell a friend. Pass it along to someone. We are always eager to get the word out. And we're also eager to hear from our listeners. So if you made... if you have questions about this episode or arguments, send us a note, mirrorfidelity.com. You can see all the past episodes as well. And you can join the merry band of Patreon supporters. Shout out to them who keep our hearts encouraged and our coffers not completely diminished. We are grateful to all of you who have supported the show. So you can join the merry band at mirrorfidelity.com. We're going to be back in the weeks to come with other conversations about the world around us and how the gospel intersects with it. Until then, though, this has been Mirror Fidelity.